You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino.
Time to check in with Jim Ellis, ellisinsight.com, for a look at the week in politics. Jim, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you.
Well, it's the Senate passing the $95 billion in war aid to Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan after the House and sent off to the president. This was a contentious fight, mostly among Republicans. When you only have a one or two vote lead, the Republican holdouts wanted money for the border with Mexico, which is a very important issue. But at the same time, they had these looming challenges overseas.
Yeah, it seems all or nothing, and there's just no discipline on the Republican side. And you look at the Democrat side, I mean, they have their infighting, too. I mean, with their hard left, the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez crowd and what they call the squad, they're just as divisive on the Democratic side as on the Republican side. But the difference is there's much more discipline on the Democratic side because they're much better at getting together to, you know, advance the bigger picture. And the Republicans, that small group that because the majority is so small, they can, you know, really the tail wagging the dog. And it's unfortunate, and it's going to hurt them here.
Well, you had Senator Ted Cruz going on Fox News saying that he was voting against it because it didn't have, you know, money for the Mexico border. But I wonder if he were the deciding vote on whether this thing passed, I bet you he would have approved it. Your thoughts?
Yeah, he may have. I think, actually, I do kind of think there are good arguments on both sides.
Yes, there are.
Because, obviously, you know, we have, what, $34 trillion in debt, and we're coming up with ways to spend even more money for foreign countries. But American interests and world interests are at stake there. So I understand that part of the argument. On the other hand, people like Ted Cruz say, hey, we need to have these vehicles to be able to do something about our own border. I think that's a legitimate point, too. So it's really kind of a tough issue, and I think both sides have legitimate points.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk about the race this week in Pennsylvania and the Senate race, what it's going to be. Kind of take us into that story.
Well, I thought the turnout, which I follow a lot, and we've talked about on the program there many times over the primaries here, we did see the Democrats actually have about 100,000 more people turn out to vote, which I was a little bit surprised about because this is the first swing state where we've seen more Democrats participate in a primary. And it does sort of verify some of the polling now that shows an uptick for Biden. And, you know, we haven't had a primary for a while. Pennsylvania is the only state that has a primary in April. And so, you know, it's again, I think it's reflective of the ebbs and flows within the political cycle. So I think we're going to see some ups and downs all the way from now until November. And whoever's on that upslide heading into October is likely to win this thing. So I thought from the Republicans probably should be a little disappointed at those turnout numbers out of Pennsylvania. I think it's a bad sign.
And in that particular case, they decided it's going to be Casey versus McCormick in Pennsylvania's high-stakes U.S. Senate contest. Let's see. So kind of lay out what has to happen here. I mean, you've got somebody who's been serving before and then somebody who's challenging him. What do you think?
I think this is a tough one for the Republicans. I think what's going to happen here is they're going to spend an awful lot of money and they're talk about this race being in play, and I just don't think it is. I think the Bob Casey Jr., he votes the left-wing slate the whole way, but he doesn't come across that way. And he talks about how moderate he is, and just like his father, so keep in mind, Casey's been elected three times to the Senate, but his father, who truly was a conservative Democrat and a pro-life Democrat, unlike his son, he was elected twice as governor and twice as attorney general. The Casey name is a legacy in Pennsylvania. And I just think this one's the fool's gold for the Republicans. And I have a hard time seeing David McCormick, who ran the world's largest hedge fund for a while, is a clear one percenter in terms of wealth, kind of lives in Connecticut. I just think it's a bad fit for Pennsylvania. And I always thought, remember, he ran in 2022 and barely lost that primary to Dr. Oz. And before the stroke, I thought Senator Fetterman would have wanted to run against McCormick because they know how to beat a candidate like that.
Yeah.
The Democrats do, in terms of, you know, the class distinction, the fact that he's really, he grew up in Pennsylvania, but he's not really one of them. And that matters in a state like Pennsylvania. And I think this race is fool's gold for the Republicans.
Well, we saw what happened with Dr. Oz and kind of having your house on the other side of the border and all that. And,
yeah,
you know, it doesn't bode well. But some pundits are saying that this is the seat that determines whether Republicans can grab control of the Senate. Do you agree that it's that harsh? It's down to that? Or do you think there's still other paths to get there?
Oh, many other paths to get there, because, frankly, I would put this one at the bottom of the list, because you've got West Virginia's first. That's going to flip to the Republicans. So probably their worst case scenario, because they just don't have much to defend, is 50-50. And because right now the Democrats have 51-49, West Virginia flipping because Manchin's not running, it goes to 50-50. Ohio and Montana are the next two that are the top tier races. I think Nevada becomes the top tier race after the June primary. I'd put Michigan also in that category ahead of Pennsylvania. And so I think it's those states that I'd look more closely at, because of all those states we just talked about, the Republicans would only need one of them to come home just for a bare majority, but they really need to get several more to protect them against Senate maps in 2026 and 2028 that will favor the Democrats.
Jim Ellis, EllisInsight.com. Now to President Biden being criticized for his response to pro-Palestinian protests on university campuses. The connection has been made to, why isn't he more like Eisenhower and saying at these colleges that are overrun with protesters, if you don't stop now, I'll bring in the troops. He doesn't want to do that, does he?
No, because this issue, this Israel issue, is the worst one Biden faces, and he's making all the classic mistakes, because obviously there is a strong base of Arabs in the Democratic Party, as well, historically, the Jewish vote has been Democratic. And so he's got two factions within his own party that are literally at war, and he's got to try to maneuver a way politically where he comes out unscathed, and he can't do it. And he's making all the wrong mistakes, because originally he's, oh, I'm strongly Israel, and now he's equivocating on that, backing way back down, and now doing nothing on these campus protests. That it's really absurd that this is still going on. And he shows no leadership. So this is a big loser for him, no matter what he does. And I think he's making the classic mistake.
There's been some analysis of whom the protesters are, many of them young and women. And ironically, those who look at the Palestinian side as not being very, well, warm and cozy to women in their culture. And they've also been supported by LGBT groups, which, again, Hamas doesn't think well of. Your thought about what's going on, what's motivating young people, especially in these colleges, to take up the banner and to fight, and Israel's the bad guy?
Well, as you're mentioning, and this doesn't really make any sense when you drill down to it, so what's always at the bottom of a situation like that that doesn't make any sense? And when you peel back the onion, what's always the final result? Money. And it's support. Who's funding all of this? There's got to be money flying around to coordinate all of these protests. And I guarantee you there, these protesters are getting money from some sources there. Maybe it's China. Maybe it's some world enemy of the United States is trying to create more protests and more unrest within this country. I think if you really drill down into what's going on here, you'll see the end result of this is money. Because, Larry, you're right in the way you've just described it. This makes no sense as to why women and the LGBT community types would be out there supporting Hamas and these countries like Iran, who will kill women and LGBT people if they get out of line or don't wear the right garb, or just because of who you are. It just doesn't make any sense. So there has to be another reason.
And then the point has been raised, trying to conflate and put together Biden's forgiveness of college loans with the constituency he needs. to the young people who are protesting to the constituency he needs. Saying it all kind of adds up in one ball with the bow on it, tied up, and that's what Biden needs. He needs the young college students to be freed of their financial obligations they signed on to, and to not do too much to stop the protesters, because even though he says he wants to, because he needs those votes too.
Well, exactly, but it's consistent with how Joe Biden operates. All of his decisions and his moves are based on what he thinks is good for his own political health and future. It has nothing to do with what's best for the country or what's best for the people here. It's what's best for what he thinks is best for his career. And that's always the way he's been.
Democrats leveraging the abortion topic. We've got the governor of California, Newsom, out in front talking about ways California can help women from Arizona get abortions, saying that Donald Trump, even though he says he won't sign off on any legislation for a national ban, that he would do it anyway. They're going to ride this this topic, aren't they?
There's no doubt about it, because it was a big winner for them in 2022. It was really the only issue that the polling suggested that favored them. And they knew they had to run a single issue campaign. And then they got a big break because the Republicans fumbled the ball and basically had no response.
Yeah.
And they're going to continue to play that, because the numbers are totally against them on who handles the issues better. And abortion and climate change are about the only two where the Democrats now have a little bit of an advantage. They have a big advantage on abortion and a little bit of one on climate change. And so that's where they're going to drive those issues, because they really, what are they going to talk about? Are they going to talk about the debt? Are they going to talk about foreign affairs? They really have nothing to say. Are they going to talk about safety, crime in the cities? No.
Yeah, they can't really talk about the hardworking blue-collar people who didn't get college loans, who are now going to be paying the end run of the loans that are being defaulted on by the elite, the college students. I mean, it's really bothersome to some people. It's interesting if this will can be kind of coddled together some more by Trump. We'll have to see. We're out of time. Jim Ellis, EllisInsight.com. We'll do it again next week.
You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino.
Rabbi Ron LaPaz is an L.A. rabbi and advocate for interreligious understanding across the globe. Rabbi, thank you so much again for joining us on our program.
Of course. My pleasure, Larry.
Pro-Palestinian protests seem to be growing in our colleges across this country. They seem like there are more of them and growing. And I want to get your reaction to what you're seeing. What in that voice inside of you, what has it been saying? Have you watched the TV? Have you seen some of these protests?
Yeah, I've been watching them online. I typically listen to and read my news. I've been horrified, actually. I mean, not just a little alarmed, but horrified by what I've seen. The vitriol, the anger toward a Jewish professor, toward Jewish students, just what's happened. What concerns me the most isn't just this moment, what they're doing, what they're saying, but what it represents in terms of the change in the nature of the college campus in America. And something that we've been breeding for a long time that's suddenly bearing fruit, which is a new ideology, a kind of inverse morality that exists on college campuses right now, that the most educated among us, educated in certain ideas, are telling us that the victim is the perpetrator and the perpetrator is the victim, and everything has gone blurry. We're sitting in a kind of new moral universe.
I think I pick up on the same thing. And I want to take it one step further, because if you tune into the Fox Newses of the world, they're kind of connecting two stories. They're connecting these students and the protests, pro-Palestinian hate toward Israel, with Biden's attempts to free students of billions of dollars of their student loans. And I sat there and my eyes glazed. I go, you can't combine these stories. But they did a pretty good job. And here's their theory. Their theory is Biden needs voters. Biden needs young people. Biden needs groups that have student loans. Forgive those. Those student loans are students who went to academia and are infused in this mantra about Israel. Biden worried about not getting voters because there are voters in a couple states, I think Michigan, Wisconsin, even Minnesota, that he needs to get that are on the other side. And so they whirl it all up and connect it and say, aha, there's a plan here. Forgive loans. Academia is liberal. We'll not only pay for you to learn this indoctrination, but you'll get it free.
Yeah, there's at least the hint of something there. I don't know if the dots fully connect, but at least we can see, yes, we are in a political cycle where forgiving loans certainly makes allies. You know, at what point do you not see linkage between policies and that kind of feedback, the payback in an election year? But I don't know that it's necessarily going to pay off in this case. I don't imagine that any of these young people in academia are going to vote for Biden's opponent, Trump. But I can imagine, like in Michigan, that some of them might just not vote for him at all, just might stay out of the election, you know, or vote for another candidate. I don't know. I don't know if that's realistic. I just think that, yes, it's a policy that will be popular with the people who are espousing views that are antithetical to the logic, not only of any White House, but normal moral thinking. But, yeah, there could be a link. I'm not convinced of it yet.
Just keep an eye on it, all right?
Right, now, next time, exactly, we'll know.
Let's listen to some sound clips. This is Henry. He's a senior. He's a senior at Columbia University who says that Jews no longer feel safe on campus.
I've been not walking alone at night. It's just hard to see that we have reached such a point where we can't talk to each other. We can't interact in normal ways that we should be able to interact.
Hey, it's free speech. The other side says, there's nothing that says we have to interact with one another. There's nothing that says that our language has to even be something you like. You know, where does free speech end? See, a lot of the people who are pushing this say they're doing nothing wrong. They're just, you know, pointing out the things that are going on. Here's an example. Here's a student organizer at Columbia University. Here we go.
We believe that we're very clear in our community guidelines. There is no room for hate here. This is simply a peaceful protest in solidarity with Gaza, making divestment demands from the university.
And you, Rabbi, you're the one laying in your layers of faith and belief on top of that. Is there any truth to that?
Well, I can't believe that we're back to the same conversation that you and I were having a couple of months ago.
Yeah.
When these things were going on at Harvard.
But you see what she's saying there? She's saying that they're following the guidelines for the most part. You know, no Jews are being killed right now. I mean, yeah, whatever. Right. But you're infusing your belief on top of this when she has just as much free speech right to say what she thinks. If she wants to be pro-Gaza, go for it. She's pro-Gaza. This is America. That's what she would argue.
Well, I don't disagree with her. I think we have a place in this country, whether we like it or not, for even ugly free speech, as long as it doesn't incite violence.
Yeah, but where's the line?
People say whatever they want on campus.
You're outraged by it already. You began this.
I am outraged by it. What I'm most outraged by is that it isn't actually peaceful protest. It's, you know, when a girl gets stabbed in the eye with a Gaza flag, a Palestinian flag, and then she's trying to go after the perpetrator, the protesters create a blockade so she can't legally exercise her right to bring the person to justice who injured her in the eye. Actually, she ended up hospitalized for it.
Yeah.
So that's when clearly a line was crossed. Somebody holding a placard can say essentially whatever they like, but they're actually making it intimidating for Jewish students and, of course, Israeli students to come on campus or, as that student said eloquently, to even walk around the streets of New York at night. I think it's become dangerous. It's not merely an exchange of words and ideas. It's becoming very, very dangerous for Jewish students, yeah, not only in New York, but obviously there.
So let's jump to what are the ways this plays out. Is it in the courts? Is it the fact that certain titles require anti-Semitism not to exist and you have to protect the safety of students? Is that how it's going to play out? Or is it going to be like this individual Kraft who owns a sports team who's going to pull his millions of dollars, except for his center, which he's going to keep funding, that's going to get these universities who are loaded with money?
Yeah, I think it's A and B. I think the courts have a role to play here in terms of what's permissible in terms of free speech, where anti-Semitism can not exist, which is should be anywhere, but clearly in on campuses that are funded by federal money.
Got it. A and B.
But certainly people like Kraft
have
a lot of power.
How about C? How did conservatives stay out of academia and not control it like the left has? How did Jews not control education? And we sit here and complain about this, but you're not in the classroom. And where are all the other Jewish professors to write this? In other words, this has been going on for years. When I went to school, the left had already kind of infused its way into college and into the classroom. Aren't we a little late to this game?
I think we are.
Yeah,
I
but
the
but
Jews
there's
that are all over the campuses, and there are many, many Jewish professors are leftist professors. I think there are very few that are more conservative, and I think for whatever reasons, that's something we have to analyze. There's a book to be written about that. Certainly, articles will be written about it. But part one of the questions is: would that professor have gotten funding 20 years ago or today?
No.
Would they've got any kind of seat in the school?
No.
My guess is, based on the climate that's existed now for decades, that they wouldn't have been welcome in those places. They do exist in other campuses, but not in these major campuses that are getting D's and F's on the grading scale for anti-Semitism in this case. No.
So I asked the same question to the business community when they see things turn south in California when it comes to minimum wage for fast food workers. You know, where are the business people in fighting back? And they go, well, the unions are so strong and organized. Organize, my friend. Do something.
Right.
And nothing happens. We're quick to complain about it. There are some who say it's too late. You lost the war. Your reaction?
Oh, I hate to agree with them. It's not my nature. I hate to think that we lost the war. I think we lost this cycle that we'll look back on, you know, I hope, I'll say God willing, and say, look at this era in which leftism swept through American campuses and European campuses.
Is Israel in trouble?
I think Israel's not existentially in trouble, but certainly in a dangerous point right now. Within the country, its own politics, the division that exists there and here are the same, maybe more inflamed, or clearly more inflamed there right now because of the war. And mostly because of the hostages.
Yeah.
I think that people are at the edge because of the hostages.
When this all went down, October, when it took place.
Sure.
There were people who said it's going to turn south for Israel because Israel is going to go in. They're going to go into these neighborhoods and they're going to be relentless and civilians are going to die. And then there's going to be a pushback. That's exactly what happened, didn't it?
Right. Yeah, I agree with that assessment. I think on October 7th by midnight, we said, well, we have the world's support, just as we did, you know, after 9/11. You know, there's something amazing that happens when you realize that people say, yes, we are with you. We have your back. But we also knew that by October 12th, it would change. And Israel was very, very clear. It said, this is what we will be doing. It will be a long, drawn-out war. They said that over and over again. Civilians will die because that's inevitable. But what they've done that's remarkable is minimize civilian casualties at the levels that are unheard of in previous wars by other countries, including our own. So they've done a very good job of it. We just need it to end now so that we can focus on other things and so that ultimately the future of that region can be seen and rebuilt. And I think a piece of that that you and I will be talking about will be what happens with Saudi Arabia in the coming weeks and months. I don't think they're waiting at the sidelines for this war to end. I think there are some, and there's some progress that's being made.
As always, thank you for your thoughts and you know your honesty in sharing this story. It's frustrating for a lot of us watching it unfold. Certainly is, isn't it?
Yeah.
Thank you,
absolutely.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Of course, Larry. Thank you,
Rabbi Ron LaPaz, there, a Los Angeles rabbi and advocate for interreligious understanding across the globe. Stay right there. There's more politics and issues with Larry Marino coming up in the second half of our program right after this.
You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino. AM 590, The Answer. You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino.
Former L.A. County D.A. Steve Cooley is joining us right now as we talk about some of the stories taking place in Southern California. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, happy to do it, Larry, and there's certainly a lot going on.
Certainly is. We start the week, I guess it was over the weekend, last weekend, with a story about jewelers who are being hit in their cars, literally. They're being observed as they leave a jewelry store with lots of, you know, jewelry, and then they're tracked, and then it's coordinated effort. One car gets in front of it, the other one behind it, and they get into a accident so they can get out and maybe stab their tires, hold them up, stick them up for that. Your reaction, this is kind of something, it seems a little new for Southern California. Very weird. Your thoughts?
Actually, it's not new. This particular criminal technique has been going on for a decade or so. It involves individuals, oftentimes of Colombian nationality, who are in this country, and they target jewelers by surveilling the jewelers who go to the jewelry mart, and then they do basically what you said they would do. Corner the jeweler, punch out his tires, and then steal his jewelry. It's not new. What may be new is the fact that if they ever do get caught, they're not going to be punished severely by the current district attorney, Gascon.
Yeah. And that does seem to be kind of the sad thing in all this, is if we do catch these people, there's this theory that, you know, let's give them the benefit of a doubt. Let's not go too harsh on someone. But we've got that going on. We've got other burglary instances. We've got a story in the Wire from Monday. A woman who was stabbed in the throat while she waited for a train at a Los Angeles metro station has died. It happened at about 5 Monday morning at the Universal City B-Line station. Police have arrested a suspect. What's going on? What is this violence in the Southland that makes you... I wouldn't want to take a metro. I'm sorry, I hate to besmirch the whole thing, but that doesn't sound good. And I've heard of other instances of violence on those lines.
It's probably a combination of two things. Lack of law enforcement presence, which deters such crimes. And I'm going to just guess this individual, the assailant, was some kind of a crazy meth-addicted homeless person. And so those are, it's a bad mix. No real presence of law enforcement. And essentially people that commit crimes without any particular reason and are in a subway system, whether it's New York, Chicago, or Los Angeles, is going to be a magnet for crime. And the crimes that occur near or on a subway or a bus, for that matter, will be highly publicized because so many people do rely upon public transportation.
Lack of law enforcement around. There's a story this week about what's behind LAPD's staffing woes. You saw that story, the police academy graduating about half as many recruits as needed to meet the mayor's goal. I mean, how do you expect people to want to go into law enforcement when starting, I guess, during the pandemic in 2020, you had this kind of negative kind of press about law enforcement that I don't think was justified?
Well, it wasn't justified, but you did have, in reaction to the summer of violence and riots and demonstrations in 2020, there was this political reaction by some of our weak-kneed politicians to somehow or another support the defund the police movement. Mayor Garcetti, I think, struck $155 million from LAPD's budget. The Board of Supervisors, being a little more sophisticated and perhaps more clever, put Proposition J on the ballot, which reduced the budget of the sheriff, probation, and the DA to fund and have that money go to prevention and other rehabilitation-type efforts in response to the demands of the defund the police people. That was thrown out later as unconstitutional, and it's probably still on appeal. But just a dodge on their part, a complete dodge.
Yeah. A lot of law enforcement officers wanting to get out of the profession. Huge retirements, huge leaving the force. That doesn't bode well. You don't see many officers around with vehicles these days, and I guess the bad guys know it.
Well, I think that's true. You know, one of the greatest deterrents is seeing a police car drive up and down your street or in a commercial area where you're about to, where you're thinking about committing a crime. But the reason we don't have the same number of applicants pursuing a really pretty good job with pretty good benefits and pretty good salary, I think, is partly the attitude manifested, the negative attitude manifested towards that particular profession. And secondly, I think the applicant pool may not be as good as it once was in the Los Angeles region.
Mm, interesting. Okay, then you have Mayor Bass's house, the official mayor's residence, which you said you've been to before you told me that, gets hit by a burglar early Sunday morning. Not too early, like 6:40 in the morning. If I remember correctly, at a different location a couple of years ago, she had a couple of weapons stolen from a residence she was living in. You know, how do you do the Chamber of Commerce speech of come to Los Angeles when even the mayor's residence, which is pretty well fortified, gets hit?
I have been to the official mayor's residence when Dick Reardon was our mayor, and I'm pretty familiar with it. And I'm sure it's heavily secured with alarms, cameras, and other such devices. And the question is, what was the motive of this particular burglar slash intruder? Because the Bass family wasn't home. Was it to do her harm? That's serious business. Was it to just steal like most burglars do? That's pretty serious too. The question now becomes, since this is a residential burglary and a serious crime under the penal code, will the LA County DA's office under George Gascon file serious priors, which do enhance the sentence because the person is a repeat offender? That is a question that is fair to ask because Gascon banned the filing of priors when he first came into office way back when.
Mm. And there's some violence that may be in the background allegedly here too, so we're going to have to see what happens. All right, you've got the Supreme Court this week that heard arguments on whether homeless people can be cited for camping on public property. We began talking about homeless people. At the center of the case is that Oregon City Grants Pass, which had been enforcing ordinances that ban camping in city parks and on public property. A lower court ruled that if there are more homeless people than available shelter beds, the city can't fine people for camping outside. Opponents of the city's rules argue they violate the Eighth Amendment's protection against excessive fines and cruel and unusual punishment. What do you do about the homeless situation in this era, D.A. Cooley? Because, I mean, I've walked in downtown, and you can't go a block without somebody kind of talking to themselves. They're not on a cell phone, but they're kind of, you know, sitting there screaming at someone. How do we get our city back?
Well, it's not just the fact they're crazy, drug addicted, and unpredictable in their behavior. They are camping out on city sidewalks and in other public property locations. The last person I think tried to think about that was Sheriff Villanueva. Of course, he's not around to do that anymore, but that is a problem to be addressed. Why do they get to camp out on a city sidewalk 24 hours a day? There may be some ordinances that they can put in place to deter that. I'm not sure, but I'll tell you, the Oregon problem in terms of citing individuals in public parks for camping out, that law is going to be subject to the Boise decision, which essentially says you can't do anything to them unless you got a place to put them. That's sort of the standard, the litmus test. You can't do anything to them unless you got a place to put them. So it isn't just housing either, because you can put them in various places, locations, and because of their mental condition, their drug addiction, or combinations of both, they'll just destroy wherever they are. And the taxpayers are on that hook. It's a very challenging problem, and one that I think Prop 47 contributed to it, and other laws in California, and our current DA, of course, contributing to leniency has helped create the homeless problem, although it's basically up to the municipalities and the county government to deal with it. They've also failed, apparently, after $24 billion that is unaccounted for.
Yeah. I think there's this philosophy that everybody's entitled to do whatever, and we don't want to make somebody have to come indoors and sober up because maybe they enjoy that, and that's their freedom. Look, these people are not mentally capable of making the decision. They are a nuisance to all of us, a threat to some. You're right. They're camping on our sidewalks, blocking the path of people who have a right to go to work. Why isn't there more outrage? All that we hear about is, oh, well, the state spent $20 billion and they never, ever did a study on whether the programs work or not. That's the kind of stories we're hearing here. I want some optimism. I want to hear that there's something good in the works. What, is there anything positive you can tell me?
No. The outrage, I think, really is out there among the citizens. They're as frustrated as probably our elected officials in the fact that the problem is growing despite the allocation of a tremendous amount of money and resources thrown at it. It's only getting worse. And, boy, it's an eyesore. Between graffiti in this county and the homeless problem in this county, we should be embarrassed in Los Angeles County.
Well, voters do have a choice coming up in November to change course on their DAs, to move back to a law and order type situation, prosecuting crimes. That's a choice. We have a choice in the presidential election. But California is just so progressive. Nah, they don't want to hear about it. They don't want law and order, do they?
Well, I think they're going to want a different district attorney rather than so-called progressive George Gascon. He's been a failure across the board. I'm sure he's made some contributions to the homeless, but more than that, he's been really a threat to public safety. He's the most dangerous man in Los Angeles County right now because of the way he thinks.
Yeah.
So the public can get, the voters can get rid of him in November and see if the district attorney's office can play some role in addressing the homeless problem.
Right.
But mostly, they better start addressing the crime problem and the punishment problem according to the law of the state of California.
Yeah.
That's a big problem that has to be corrected, and Nathan Hochman will be the guy to do it.
And voters may have a chance here. I guess they're, if they say they've gathered the signatures, but, you know, to modify Prop 47, I hope that moves forward, and that's on the ballot there. Thank you, Steve Cooley, former L.A. County D.A. Steve Cooley, talking crime with us. We really appreciate it. It's not always great news, but we really have to be honest about what we're facing, and you call them as you see them, don't you?
I sure try.
You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino.
And Hyde Dunsmore joins us once again for our look into politics and recall and whatever else is going on in California. How are you, Ann Hyde Dunsmore?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing well. Let's talk about the latest on the recall. How many requests? How many are out there? What's the latest?
The latest is we've got over 150,000 petitions on the street, which is great. We're months ahead of where we were this time in the last recall. We've got everybody's now empowered and has everything they need. And we have chairs in almost every county of the state. And we feel really good about it. A lot of positive feedback. The groundswell amongst the volunteers and the voters of their distrust and dislike of Newsom is far higher than it was before. We were successful last time.
You know, you were telling me, and I didn't believe it, but I got to say you were right. Newsom, even though he's not on the ballot, he's showing more evidence of running for elective office in Washington and running against Trump. He's, I guess, come out, pretty much said if Trump is elected, he is going to ban abortion nationwide, even though he says he isn't. So, they're playing that abortion thing.
Yeah, well, worse than that, or to that point, he has called a major kickoff. This is what he called it, a kickoff for his national 2024 campaign. With Campaign for Democracy and outlined his key points for his 2024 campaign. Well, I don't know what campaign he's talking about other than president. Mm. So he has a Zoom call scheduled for tomorrow evening. The headline was, that it's a kickoff, and he is explaining to his small donors and volunteers his decision to hit the campaign trail on a national level for tomorrow night, a kickoff announcement.
So how about, did I miss something? Have we had the State of the State address yet? Or
we haven't for 2 years in a row. And here's another thing. A Washington Examiner headline, California Unemployment Fund, insolvent. Insolvent due to $55 billion in fraud. And another announcement this week is that Oracle will be leaving for Tennessee. So we are losing yet another tech giant to another state. And there's more where that came from. The list of things in the last few days is huge.
Yeah, this is big on the it's big on employers because the way the law is written, you know, as you and I know, California spent like a drunken sailor in trying to get benefits out there to the tune of huge losses and checks going to people in prisons and out of the country and all that. And then the way the law works is employers have to pay it back. Employers have to pay it back.
Yes, so that's what it is. It's they basically assess small business owners the a tax to cover the fraud at the EDD. And then on top of it all, you saw Newsom's more recent announcement that he is going to hold the cities more accountable. It's like, well, for the homelessness issue, and this is typical of him. He's a big finger pointer. He's he is not taking any responsibility for the homeless issue at all, even though it's under his watch and his budgeting that $15 billion was spent on the homelessness crisis and moved the needle backwards. He spent money and did less and made it work.
And add to that the report that says that there was no transparency, no measurement of where the money results.
That would have been right, and that would have been more transparent had he done his job and made sure that the audits that are due in December were actually made public and available for use during this current budget negotiations on how to fix this deficit that he still won't admit is much, at least twice as high as what he thinks it is.
Now, do you know H.D.? Because I've met him a few times over the years. H.D. Palmer from California's Department of Finance. There's these different estimates still flying out there. Remember, there was like 70-something, and then there's
73 billion.
And then there's 51 billion.
It was upgraded from 65 billion, and Newsom hasn't responded to any of that, and is sticking to his guns on the 35 billion estimate that he has, even though he has only found about 11 billion to deal with it. By the way, you've probably seen this, and it's going to be very incumbent upon them to revise numbers, but this insurance crisis we have now with landlords not being able to get insurance for their apartment buildings anymore. He's now driving landlords out of business. And then on top of it all, he's nationally, we have an issue, which of course applies to the state in a big way, which is the headlines on Breitbart where migrants are securing billions of dollars in taxpayer funding for housing, food, healthcare costs, and healthcare costs.
Yeah.
That's spearheaded here by Gavin Newsom. So it's like, hey, America, this guy's running for president. He's spearheading issues that are not only bankrupting California, but are bankrupting other sanctuary states across the nation as well.
So this is, you know, Microsoft's little MSN news thing that they put together isn't exactly a conservative deal here. I mean, they run a lot of articles that are picking on Trump and stuff like that. But they did happen to have one that I wanted to say for you. It's titled Californians Learn Consequences of Newsom's Spending Spree. And it's just about this budget. And they try to couch the words because they want to talk about revenue enhancements. That kind of scares me when they talk revenue enhancements because I thought that means taxes. They don't want to say it that much, but they need to quote, preserve the programs that help those most in need. And the only way they can do it is, you know, come up with some more money. They have these funds they can kind of raid, these funds that are for emergencies, but they have to be very careful how they do it. And then there's Prop 98, which you know all about, the thing that demands that a majority of the money go to schools first. Whatever you take in, every dollar, a certain amount has to go to the schools automatically. And how are those?
Well, and that's being mismanaged too, Larry, because we now have the least educated students in the country, and that's a new list we're on now. Not that it was good before, but now we are the least educated. We are educating our students less than any other state.
As we put the welcome mat out, instead of the barbed wire at the border, and offer up education and offer up health care for those coming in illegally. A couple of my guests
recently... Healthcare, food, and housing. Okay. Healthcare, food, housing.
Yeah. And a couple of my guests say he has to do that because of the declining numbers of people fleeing the state. If he doesn't shore up the numbers with illegals coming in any way they can, we'll lose up to five, if not more, congressional seats the next time it's done.
Yeah, well, people need to take action. We're at rescuecalifornia.org, rescuecalifornia.org. You can pull down a petition, fill it out, get your friends to fill it out. There's room for at least seven signatures on each petition. Fill out the whole thing. Get a, pull down more than one. Get your friends to do it. Send them in. This man needs to get a message. And they, we also have a responsibility as Californians who are very well versed in the foibles of Newsom, and let America know that this is a bad governor. We might be the worst in everything, but we also have something else. We have the worst governor in the country by every measure, every metric available. Worst on taxes, worst on job growth, worst on healthcare, worst on homelessness. It boggles the mind, and he's adding to the list each week. This is why he refuses to have a state of the state. He will not subject himself to questions by the press. We have leadership in this state who is not, who are not being leaders in calling out this man. I don't care what party you're in, you have a responsibility. And pointing fingers at everybody else is not how you solve problems.
Indeed. I just want to quickly let you respond to, you know, the general critics out there who've kind of poo-pooed this, saying, ah, it's a distraction. You know, she's not going to kick him out. He has all the money in the world. They're mostly Democrats here. They're going to come to his side. You know, you've heard a little bit of the chatter. What's your
reaction? A lot of it.
Okay. What do you say about
that? My reaction is that if people are going to be complacent at this point about California, they deserve what they get. And a lot of people, I will tell you, it's going up the food chain. They are experiencing these problems now. Most of them are getting hit really hard with the insurance crisis and groups like State Farm pulling out of California.
Oh, yeah.
That's really ringing the bell. And at some point, they're going to look at the people who are saying this is a distraction. The answer is a distraction from what? Making our state livable.
Yeah.
If you live here, you understand the issues. If you, and now more people are experiencing it, even the naysayers.
Well, yeah, the insurance.
So at some point,
the insurance thing is huge. And when I thought that had been worked out, there was about 6 months ago some article that Ricardo Lara had worked it out. He's the insurance commissioner, where they were going to get to raise their rates 30 or 40%. They're still leaving. They're still leaving it. I guess
it's too much. The profit margins are being erased. And in fact, people are going in the red. In fact, some of them are going to have lapses in their insurance coverage, which will then make it more difficult for them to get it in the first place. The names of the grifting companies that are coming in to pick up those insurance policies is epic. And then you have to look at the insurance commissioner and go, well, now how are you going to approve these people for doing business here when they won't be, we're already in a mess because we haven't even paid the people who have burned out of their homes during the fires. He's doing so many things that are bad that people are having trouble standing in line for the things that have already happened, i.e. the fires.
Well,
people are not receiving their benefits from his biggest donors.
Yeah.
That's the other issue. Yes, you're not getting your money from PG&E. Go and check online and see how much he's getting from Chevron. See how much he's getting from PG&E. The California Chamber endorsing against the recall. Take a look at their board of directors. Are they really representing the businesses in California? My guess is no. I think they're caught in the vice grip of Sacramento politics where the governor says you better do this or else. So that's it. Vote him out and get out of the stranglehold he has on everything that we need in order to fix these problems.
Out of time.
www.rescuecaliforniaspelledout.org.
You're listening to Politics and Issues with Larry Marino. AM 590, The Answer.